I'm Adam Coleman, inviting you to the fifth season of The Cosmic Library from LitHub. This season, we go on our tiniest reading adventure yet, into short stories in the U.S. But this too turns out to be almost all-encompassing.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life.
That's Oxford literary scholar Andrew Kahn, who gives us a deep history of the short story. And we hear from The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman, who explains her work as an editor of short fiction.
You know, if you are melding with another person, you don't turn that person into you, but you get to know the ins and outs of that person. So, and it's sort of like that. I always feel involved with the stories.
We bounce around between the history and current life of short stories with the novelist Justin Taylor.
The nice thing about it going out of fashion is that it really frees you up to relate to it in a different way.
This being the Cosmic Library, we make sure to go way beyond U.S. short stories, too. Here's the Washington Post critic, Becca Rothfeld.
A lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures.
And the actor Max Gordon Moore reminds us just how wild short stories can be. With a reading in its entirety of Wakefield, the intensely strange, classic Nathaniel Hawthorne story.
He had contrived, or rather he had happened to dissever himself from the world, to vanish.
Get ready for all that and more in a season about short stories, small windows into vast universes. It's season 5 of The Cosmic Library, available soon wherever you go for podcasts.
Welcome to the Maris Review, brought to you by LitHub Radio.
Well, I'm so happy to have Erin Summers joining us at the Maris Review. Erin is the author of Stay Up with Hugo Best, which is maybe the most nuanced look at sexual dynamics in the talent industry that I've read in a while. Welcome, Erin.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Yay. Do you want to talk a little bit about the book and what it's all about?
Sure. Well, it's a novel, and it's about retiring late-night talk show host Hugo Best, kind of a David Letterman or Jay Leno type, who on the last night of his show, the last taping of his show, has an encounter with a young staffer at an open mic, and on a whim, invites her back to his house in Connecticut for a long weekend, for Memorial Day weekend. And she surprises herself by accepting, and it kind of unfolds from there.
Excellent. So the first thing I wanted to ask you immediately was, how did you research this book? You've never worked in late night, right?
Right. No, I've never worked in late night.
And have you ever done stand-up comedy?
I've never done stand-up comedy. but I guess I just fancy myself funny and thought I could write the jokes, or thought I had a feel for writing stand-up jokes, kind of based on nothing.
Have you been to a lot of shows, or do you watch on Netflix, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I am a comedy fan, and I like stand-up, and I like, you know, funny movies and funny TV, and I've written comic fiction as long as I've been writing fiction.
Right.
So I felt like I kind of had a feel for the timing, and I thought that it would also be a fun formal challenge to try to write stand-up jokes, because I'd never had before. But right, I had no insider knowledge of working in late night. Thank you. So it was sort of just starting from scratch. So I just read a lot of books. There are a lot of really great books out about it. The Late Shift is a great one.
Yes.
Another one that I read about the 70s comedy scene at the Comedy Cellar in L.A. is called I'm Dying Up Here, which they made a so-so TV series about.
Yes, fair.
What else? I read a biography of Leno. I read an oral history of the writer's room. David Letterman. I read, let's see, what else? I don't know. I did a lot of reading that I can't think of off the top of my head.
And how about watching? Were you going back and watching old episodes, or were you watching stand-up?
Yeah, I watched like a lot of old clips. I kind of went host by host, starting with Carson. And so I watched like a lot of Carson, and I watched a lot of Leno, and I watched a lot of Letterman. Sort of just to get that like hacky talk show host rhythm down to get a feel for it more than anything. And on top of that, I listened to a ton of WTF with Marc Maron just to hear about what comedians' lives are like typically and what their trajectories are,
right?
And to be inspired about for Hugo's backstory. And other things I did to research were I went to a taping of Colbert.
Excellent.
The
background you give on going to the show is kind of amazing in terms of all the young kids who are there just to kind of police where you sit. And it's quite part of the experience, I guess, of attending a late night show.
Yeah, the kids really struck me, and I really wanted to use that. And I really felt a lot of empathy for them about how both stressful and boring their job seemed. Like, there's the kid that gives the same spiel over and over about, like, when you're allowed to use the bathroom and, like, how you can't eat during the taping, and just, like, the same spiel day in and day out. But they all seem really passionate. And it also seems like you could make mistakes, too. And so it's, like, fairly stressful. So I did that. And then I also, one of the most useful things I did was I talked to a former writer for Letterman who had started as a network page and worked in every job that it took to work his way up to writer.
Wow.
And he described in detail every single thing he did. And he let me grill him about, like, what did you do as a page? What did you do when you were the receptionist? What did you do? He had a couple of jobs that I think are obsolete now, too, about, like, how ticketing works. So I learned a lot from him. And, yeah, that was pretty much it. It was a lot of research. There was a lot I didn't use. I also watched a lot of documentaries. There's a great Carson documentary.
Ooh, what's it called? Do you know?
I cannot remember off the top of my head.
We'll look it up.
Yeah. There's a lot I also didn't end up using. Like, I learned a lot about Sid Caesar.
Oh.
Because I thought, so a lot of people, like, forces of comedy wrote for Sid Caesar.
Mm-hmm. Like who?
Woody Allen. Like, a lot of people in Woody Allen's cohort.
Okay.
That age of, like, 70, 80, 90-year-old dude.
Right.
All wrote for Sid Caesar. And I was like, oh, maybe Hugo should write for Sid Caesar. But then, the ages didn't work out. So I, like, needlessly went down the Sid Caesar rabbit hole. But all that stuff is really funny and really holds up. So it was never it was never boring.
How did you access that stuff? Like, is it on YouTube or
It's on YouTube.
Great.
There
okay.
are clips on
okay.
YouTube.
Well, which I know is what surprising. I'm gonna do tonight.
Yeah.
And in terms of coming up with a character of June, who is 29 and she's a writer's assistant, so she's not even like an actual writer on the show, but she's a step above a page and receptionist, I guess you would say. How did you figure out her life?
I guess I thought about myself.
Yeah.
I think that she bears a lot of similarities to where I was personally in my life when I started writing it, around 28 or 29, when I was trying to get a creative career going, but felt like I was getting nowhere. And I didn't really see how I could advance, and I didn't really see a way forward, and it didn't really seem possible. And I was really poor, and I lived in shitty apartments, and I just felt very stymied, which I think is a very common thing to happen to young people, like, striving after a
creative
career. Yeah.
Not to one of the little throwaway lines that I love that you wrote in this is when Hugo asks June why did she leave South Carolina, she says, "Hope, ambition, belief in myself, you know, kid stuff."
And that I feel like that really spoke to how creative fields can be rather disappointing at times.
Yeah. And so you spend all of your 20s trying really hard and having like a lot of passion and a lot of like belief in yourself. And I think that by the time you hit 30 or near 30, you're a little bit jaded or exhausted. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to capture that weariness with June.
Yeah. And so she's at this open mic after her rap party, and Hugo shows up. And what makes her want to go with him? She seems so cynical and so cool.
I guess her feeling is, why not? Well, the whole book is about her untangling why she's done this and right. what she's there for and what she's after.
Right.
And I think at the beginning when she hops in his chauffeured SUV, she doesn't even know. Her motivations are a little opaque to herself.
Right.
She doesn't know exactly what she wants. And so the whole weekend is about her realizing that she does want some of the things Hugo has. She does value wealth more than she's willing to admit. She is more impressed with his fame than she's willing to admit.
Right.
And I think there's also a sense of like she just wants to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that was my feeling just reading the book, that I just wanted to see where everything was going, kind of. I don't mean that in a narrative sense. I mean like what will June do? I feel like women in particular are asked often if a protagonist they write is based on themselves. And for better or for worse, sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. Where would you say June fits in?
Well, I definitely didn't sleep with David Letterman, which is what people want to have had happened. And I didn't work in late night, which is
right. That's also huge.
Right. People really want that because they want it. People just like, I think, crave autobiography or whatever reason, or like crave that it be. People think it makes it more authentic if it happened. Somehow.
Certainly, I read your author bio and was looking for she was a writer on blah, blah, blah. And it certainly doesn't diminish the story at all.
Right. Yeah, I think that I fully understand that expectation. But other than that, she's very similar to me in a lot of ways. Because it was my first novel I ever wrote, I decided to make things a little bit easier on myself in that way.
Mm-hmm.
By just letting her speak in my voice. Like have some of the same observations I would
right.
have
right.
and have my own turns of phrase and also know what I know. As a fiction writer, I really go down like I really go down the rabbit hole with that stuff. Like it instantly becomes too trippy when I start to consider what a character knows and what they don't know.
Yes.
Like if I'm writing someone who has less knowledge than me, it just becomes like a trippy experience. Or someone who's smarter than me. I'm like, how do I begin to know
what they know?
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, I'm going to eliminate that whole like psychedelic experience of trying to sort out their knowledge by just having her know what I know.
I mean, I even get like, I'm a short person. How would I ever write a tall person? That experience seems completely different.
Or like reaching for a reference, and it's you're writing a character very foreign to yourself, and it's
yes.
like, wait, does this person have that reference?
Right.
I have that reference. Do they have that reference?
Right.
And yeah, so that for me that gets like psychedelic really quickly. So I was just like, okay, I'm gonna simplify it. She knows what I know. Her observations are similar to my own, and she speaks similar to me.
So let's go deeper now into the little bit of stand-up comedy that you did write. And I mean, to set the scene, you've got this Fairfield University frat boy at this divey bar, and he's talking about how he loves to pee off porches. How do you come up with that?
So I went to go see Norm, the comedian. and weirdly for free. And he was great. Norm's great. He's very weird, and but like very funny. I really like his delivery. But anyway, that is not the point. The point is that he had an opener, and before the opener even, there was an MC. And the MC was this very typical open mic MC, in that he like they incorporate a little of their stand up or like a little, they're joking around, they tell a few jokes,
yes,
and they're bad. I think it's very typical for them to be bad. And his jokes were just so mirthless and vulgar to me that I had to use them. not literally use them, but I had to write a character, just like a repulsive open mic type guy. So there are a couple in that scene. There actually is an MC, and then there is the frat guy you talk about, where it's just like these are disgusting jokes.
When you were researching the book, do you think the quality of the jokes has changed or gotten better or worse in terms of men being aware that they're being jerks?
I don't know if men have grown more aware that they're jerks. Somewhat? I don't know. I don't know that I've seen enough comedy since to be able to like rate whether that like there has been like a huge transformation on that front. I think that type must persist though. That type of unfunny MC dude. That's like gotta still be a thing.
Yes. I can say from personal experience that I've witnessed it.
But also, so it was important to me to nail the realistic feeling, the authentic feeling of being at a comedy show and hearing that type of comedy. So I wasn't going for the best jokes I could possibly write, which is an interesting challenge.
How do you aim for mediocrity?
Right. In a way, it sort of it made the project more approachable, because if I had to, you know when you read a novel and it's like about the best poet ever in the world,
and then there's a sample,
yeah, ooh, and you're like, oh no, cringe. That's bad, or a novel within a novel, and the novel's supposed to be great, and like, it's just not great.
Yes,
so I didn't set out like I didn't set that task for myself. I wasn't like, Hugo's super funny. He's the funniest comedian in the world. And now you're going to hear his stand-up.
Yeah. Speak for him.
I was like, here are three people who are mediocre stand-ups, and they'll get maybe one laugh each. So that was actually doable. That actually made the task doable, because I don't think I could have, having never written stand-up before, written great stand-up. But certainly mediocre stand-up was attainable.
And in terms of when you started writing the book versus where we are now, how much of the Time's Up movement had happened or was happening when you were writing?
Zero had happened. So I started the book in 2014 as a short story that's basically hit the same... it had the same basic outline, and then I sat on it for a little while, and I realized that it would probably work better as a novel. It could be fleshed out more.
Yeah.
And so then I drafted it as a novel, and I finished it in October. Harvey Weinstein was October of 2017, and I finished it in November. So
did you do any going back or any, did it change the outcome at all?
It didn't change anything, because the thing is that everyone knew.
Yeah.
Right. That this was going on.
Absolutely.
In Hollywood, in comedy, in every industry, and still goes on in most industries.
We both work in publishing now.
Yeah. So although it may seem prescient, I think women aren't surprised that I knew about this, or I had a sense of this, even having not worked in entertainment. I don't think it's surprising to know about.
No.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And of course, Letterman had a weird moment in time. Was it 2009?
Yeah.
When he confessed?
Right. He was extorted, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was extorted. And so then he had to go on his show and confess that he was sleeping with his staff?
His staffer, yeah.
Yes.
So that had already happened. There had been many instances of it. Yeah. There were Cosby rumblings for years.
Yep.
And there were even Louis C.K. rumblings for years.
Yep.
If you believe Gawker, which I tended to believe Gawker on those types of rumors.
Same.
And I mean, there were all kinds of rumblings for years. It just seemed so obvious to me. Just from having been a person in the world who has interacted with a man in a professional environment that, you know.
And in terms of repercussions, certainly Letterman is doing just fine now.
Yeah, he's got his Netflix show and he's got his beard and he has his house in Connecticut. So he's fine. I think he lucked out by having it happen as early as it did.
Mm-hmm.
If it had happened around the same time as Harvey Weinstein and everybody else, I think he would have had difficulty coming back, as some of those people have had, as we've seen with Louis C.K.
Yeah. So what stand-ups do you like right now? Are you watching comedy these days, or are you watching late night?
Yeah, I have to confess I've taken a break from stand-up since writing the book.
Fair.
But I love Samantha Bee's show.
Yeah.
Because I like to see a woman.
Uh-huh.
I like John Oliver's show. As far as funny TV shows go, I'm excited Veep is back.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
Yeah. I loved did you see his movie? Did you see Death of Stalin?
No, not yet.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Okay.
I know he left Veep, but it's like Veep, but about Stalin. Yeah, it's great.
The moment.
What else is great? Oh, I love Catastrophe. Do you like Catastrophe?
So much.
I love Rob Delaney.
I love Rob Delaney too, and I saw him do stand up at Caroline's years ago now, before he became more than a Twitter celebrity.
Yeah. No, he's fantastic. And I think he's even improved, or I've become even more interested in him as he's like gone through a lot in his personal life.
Yes.
And I think it makes him such a compelling entertainer. Not that I would, of course, wish that on anyone, but he's like so compelling and so, I don't know. He's so interesting now that he's like had the shit kicked out of him by the world. I'm so interested in him. And Sharon Horgan is great too.
She's excellent.
Yeah.
Let's talk about publishing for a little bit.
Let's do it.
How long have you been working at Publishers Marketplace full time?
A little over 2 years, almost 2.5 years.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with Pub Lunch, will you give us a little roundup? Apparently you've been doing this lately.
Sure. It is a daily publishing newsletter that comes out around lunchtime or just in advance of lunchtime. And we round up all the day's publishing news, personnel moves, book selling news, awards, that sort of thing, as well as earnings and financial news and legal news. And it's got a bit of a dry sense of humor.
Yes. Or
the snarky voice that people in publishing have come to rely on.
Absolutely. What's the snarkiest thing you've ever written about?
The snark is typically not me. I'm typically very neutral. I would say it's my boss, Michael Cater, who is pretty snarky. A headline he had last week about Bret Easton Ellis.
Yes.
Who's back in the news today.
Oh, gosh.
Was something like, Bret Easton Ellis is still bored with the world or something. And then it was, you know, he like links to whatever relevant link. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess everybody's just going to be talking about the New Yorker interview for the next day, at least. I don't know how the pace of the news is so crazy, but wow.
It was quite the interview.
It really was.
He knows what he's doing.
And, like, the what not to do's are, I mean, if you're ever preparing to be an author doing an interview, just look at that.
Yeah, maybe he should have appeared to care about the subject of his book.
Yeah, it could. That might have helped. That whole I'm not into politics thing.
Have you ever looked at Jay McInerney's Twitter? I mean, Instagram?
No.
Okay. I love Jay McInerney.
Me
currently
too.
Because he is like such a contrast to Bret Easton Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
He just like has his wine.
Yes,
and his
he does.
Rich wife. And he's just like a joy. It's a joy to watch him just age and enjoy
like
life.
Like fine wines.
Yes. Did you read that thing that was in The Strategist? You know, where people
yeah.
like 10 things I can't live without?
Yes.
I recommend to all listeners Jay McInerney's Strategist, 10 things
I can't live even
without.
Imagine that must be the most luxurious crap.
Yeah, I mean, the first line of it is, oh God, I mean, there are so many good champagnes out there. So
constant problem for me.
So anyway, he's my lifestyle guru, and I recommend Jay McInerney, taking a peek into Jay McInerney's social presence if you need a break from Bret Easton Ellis.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, wide-scale observations about the publishing industry from sitting in your perch making up our lunchtime?
I don't think this is a good observation, but I think that the best books are being written by women right now.
Hell yeah.
Especially fiction.
I would agree. Which is not to say that some men aren't also very talented.
I'm trying to think of one. Like, what's a great book this spring from a male novelist?
This spring. All right. I'm on the spot, but... Well, I mean, we do have Colson Whitehead's book coming up.
Okay, summer, July.
Oh, that's summer.
July.
You're right.
For the
you
Coulson.
Call me out.
Yeah. We have a lot of big. We have Ben Lerner in the fall. Okay, he's a major male novelist. We have who else? I don't know. I don't see who are the male novelists who are coming up. Like, the cohort of female novelists that I'm in is insane.
Like, talk about them.
I mean, like, Sally Rooney's a little bit younger than me, but of course Sally Rooney jumps out. Her books are brilliant. I think Otessa Moshfegh, I hope I'm saying that name right, is incredibly brilliant. And
me too.
Possibly a contender for the best prose stylist of my generation.
I feel like my year of rest and relaxation is something that Bret Easton Ellis wishes he could have written at some point.
Definitely. Who else is coming out with a book that's great? I can't think of anyone off the top of my head, but it just feels like it's a boom in young female novelists, and it's amazing. I mean, she's not my age, but the new Susan Choi is great.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. Have you read Three Women by Lisa Tadeo?
I haven't.
You got to read it.
Okay.
It's nonfiction, but it reads like a novel, and it is incredible.
That's so good. Yeah, I tend to try to have a token man on any list that I write. But yeah, I too am consumed by women writers.
Yeah, it's exciting.
It's really exciting. I just profiled Miriam Taves.
Oh, yeah. She's amazing. I really want to read her book.
Yeah, it's really good. I think for spring... Not a novelist, but my friend Jason Green wrote a beautiful, beautiful memoir called Once More We Saw Stars, and that's coming out from Knopf, and it's devastating.
I think I saw an excerpt yesterday,
yes.
And it seemed so sad.
It's so sad, but he's able to... find beauty in some part of the world through his writing. And it's going to be incredible. You know, cool. It's not a vacation read.
Okay, so that's one man who wrote a book.
Yeah, there you go. Go, Jason.
Good stuff is being published that I'm
excited
about.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Erin.
Thank you for having me, Maris.
Are you doing any other events? The book?
I am doing an event in May at the Center for Fiction, and I'm also doing a reading at Greenlight Books in May. So find me on the internet to check out those dates and times.
Yeah.
Yeah.